All right, Dr. Hodges and Dr. Bates, there have been some really amazing photos on YKHC's Facebook page of you guys both vaccinating and Dr. Roll vaccinating our healthcare workers and first responders in many of our villages. A great question here. Do you have a plan for vaccinating elders that are not able to get to you for their vaccine? So can you speak to the plans for village-based vaccinations as well as elders who may be unable to make it to a central point to receive a vaccination?
Absolutely. So for our village-based elders, we will be traveling to the villages to provide the vaccine in the village clinics. So that will be available. And if necessary, we will go door to door. In Bethel, we're going to have several different opportunities to offer vaccination for especially our elders who are not able to travel into the hospital or easily travel into the hospital. So we have identified a couple of places for senior living that we will be offering vaccines at in person. We will be traveling to them and offering vaccine that will be announced and available in the next few coming days. I'm so excited about vaccinating that I wanted to vaccinate on Christmas Eve and Christmas Day, but I think I was overruled by our vaccine committee. So that'll be coming up, and we'll be offering that in the case. And then always just call the hotline and talk to us about your individual issues, because we want to vaccinate as many elders as we possibly can. That's so important to us.
All right, we have two related questions here. Can you please give an opinion on COVID-19 vaccinations for immunocompromised individuals? And also for someone with an autoimmune disease like JIA who is on Humira and methotrexate, should they not take the vaccine? Can you speak to that?
So I can speak generally from the kind of state perspective. In general, we're saying it's always good to talk to your primary care doctor to understand kind of the risk benefit. Immunosuppressions can be very different from, you know, having your entire kind of stem cell line being changed to very, very mild. And so it's important to talk to them about what that looks like and for a risk for other infections. But in general, everyone, even with immunosuppressive autoimmune diseases or on immunosuppressive medication, are okay to get the vaccine and are at higher risk anyway and are encouraged to do so. So I guess I'd say in general, yes, but talk to your primary care doctor.
A friendly reminder, go ahead and drop any questions into the Q&A or chat box. If you're watching via Facebook Live, go ahead and put that into the live stream chat and we'll get your questions answered. Somewhat unrelated to the vaccine, but a question for Dr. Hodges and Dr. Bates. Will villages like Akiak do testing again for COVID-19 after 90 days to see if the virus is still lingering? And relatedly, can you speak to that type of testing amidst the vaccinations?
Absolutely. So for testing for places that have had a lot of COVID, such as Akiak, what we're doing is still ongoing testing of anyone who has symptoms. So what we're recommending is that, especially in villages with known community transmission, that those individuals with symptoms get tested immediately. We have BiNeX cards available in every village, which is a rapid test that gives a result in 15 minutes that we use on people who are symptomatic, who might have symptoms. It's a pretty good test for that kind of that group of people. So that's what we would recommend for villages such as that. As far as routine follow-up testing in 90 days, we won't be doing that. So generally speaking, we ask people not to test again in that 90-day period after their initial positive test. And then after 90 days, they could test again, but only if they have symptoms. We don't want people to just routinely test after that point in time. So test if they've have other reasons to be tested. For example, they're traveling and they're testing after travel, or they are testing because they have been exposed, because they're a close contact, or because they have symptoms. So those are the reasons why we want to test, but we won't be doing any routine follow-up testing for people who previously tested positive.
A question here again about education. Do you feel confident that high-risk children will be able to return to school after educators are vaccinated? Can you speak about in-person learning with the ongoing pandemic and the new vaccination schedules?
I can start by taking it. I think that, you know, this really speaks to the point that the idea behind herd immunity is that we get a lot of people vaccinated, but we protect those who can't get vaccinated right away or for other reasons can't get it. And so, you know, an at-risk child is a perfect example of why we all need to work together to minimize our spread of COVID-19 in the community. Because if you don't have COVID-19 spreading in your community, it's totally safe for that kid to be going to school. And we want to take these extra precautions, like, you know, having a mask and having distance to minimize in case it gets in, then it doesn't spread quickly. But if you have a lot of COVID spreading throughout your village or your community, that's going to be higher risk even without that vaccine. And so that's why it's really upon all of us to continue these measures. I'm a little bit nervous, honestly, about January and February. Right now we've got holidays and we have vaccine and we're all super excited about that. And our case numbers are starting to look a little bit better. But on the other hand, it's still, winter's a long way off and we have a long way before we have vaccine for everyone who needs it. And we still have a lot of COVID spreading. So the more we can push our numbers down, the safer it is for us to have kids in school, to visit our elders, to be able to connect with each other. The safest thing we can do is not have COVID in our community. So continue to do those things. Really watch that travel again. Don't rely on one specific test. Rely on kind of that entire, use all those mitigation strategies, keep it out of your village. And then those kids can go to school much more safely. So that's why we need to still work together.
All right, there's a couple of questions here related to mutations. Can you speak on the mutations of COVID-19 and what it means for those of us in the YK Delta? Also, how do chances of mutations increase?
So great. So viruses are that they don't really live totally on their own. They need your cells to live, but they change a lot because they are these kind of tiny little bundles of RNA covered by a little fat particle. And so they change based on kind of the demands placed on them. And they're trying to just replicate and they're just trying to keep going. And they keep going when we give them a chance to, when we let it to spread from one person to another. And they keep moving and kind of transmitting to be able to do that. Coronaviruses in general don't change as fast as like influenza viruses. They tend to be a little bit more stable than them. They'll oftentimes have a small, what we call genetic shifts, where there's little tiny changes that mean nothing in the way that the disease acts, the way that it functions. And we follow those on a regular basis. We do genetic sequencing of some of the testing and send it down and are part of a big bank that takes a look at the drift and the change that we see overall. We do have numerous different, we call clads, or these little different types of changes in the state that have come from different places. We don't have any evidence of the YK1 overall. I guess my big takeaway is, what should you worry about in the YK Delta about it? I would say nothing. I think that we don't see any changes that mean anything for clinical difference on the vaccine working, on needing to wear masks, on washing your hands, on doing all these other things. They're fascinating and it's super cool pictures. And if you're really into the science of it, then come play along and follow the SPHERES data with us and the rest of it, because it's really cool. But for like what you need to do to protect yourself and your community, at this point, there are no changes that would make any difference in any of our recommendations at this time.
I'm glad we have amazing scientists that find that stuff really cool. One question here, when will inmates be eligible for vaccinations?
So from a state perspective, right now within phase 1A, we're working through inmates who are associated with the infirmary, so kind of the highest risk, as well as the workers who are caring for them. And so those, and we're treating it like a long-term care facility. So that's within 1A. So that's happening right now in Anchorage and Mat-Su, where we've got two infirmaries that are being vaccinated, both the staff as well as the inmates. Regarding kind of the rest of the inmates as well as the staff, that is at the state level, a part of the conversation within 1B that Dr. Hodges, Tessa, and I left to come here. So I'm not sure how they landed on that, and we'll have to circle back around. And as soon as those things are decided, they're up on our website. And I'd really encourage, from a state perspective, take a look on our website on what is going, where things are at. But Dr. Hodges or Dr. Bates, I don't know if you want to talk about where you guys are at with it.
No, those are really great questions. It's a population that we're highly concerned about because of the congregate living nature of the correctional facility and how difficult it is to isolate inmates who happen to become infected. So we'll definitely be looking closely for the state guidelines to make sure that we vaccinate them as soon as we possibly can. And any group kind of in the congregate living setting, whether it's the prison, the domestic violence shelter, or the shelter for persons experiencing homelessness.
Great. I am an essential worker who has been able to work from home because I am high risk. Because I have been working from home, does that put me or others in the same situation in the 1B or 1C group? Can you speak about that?
So from a state perspective, again, we do ask that if you can do your work remotely and or you can defer the work, and so something, you know, a healthcare worker who can defer work, to wait until those who really cannot defer their work, they really need to be in person, can get theirs who are other high risk moving forward. So that is our current language associated with tier three within phase 1A of healthcare workers. Again, we haven't worked through the additional phases as of yet. Again, the national committee just met on Sunday, and all this kind of moves down one step at a time. But for healthcare, essential healthcare workers, we do ask that if you can work remotely, you wait on being vaccinated until we've got more vaccine available.
Yeah, and I would say, this is Dr. Hodges, I would say I would apply that to the other tiers as well, if you're safely able to avoid being exposed to the virus. So one of the tenants of the ACIP for is people who are exposed to public facing jobs and can't avoid it. That was one of the biggest points that they were making in their discussions this weekend. So I just think about that too. So if you're able to safely stay at home and then just wait until the vaccine is a little more widely available. And in particular in our region, our focus is really going to be on our elders who have suffered disproportionately from this outbreak.
And I think Dr. Zink said something earlier today that I thought was profound and beautifully said, so I hopefully won't butcher it so much, but, you know, just because, you know, someone is in a different tier, like, you know, tier three of 1B or tier one of 1C, it doesn't mean that your work and you're not important or valid, and we don't recognize and want to prioritize, you know, you as a patient and person. It's just that we have to triage and figure out where to work together to maximize sort of our approach to get back to normal, you know, and sort of protect people who can't, as Dr. Hodges said, can't avoid sort of interacting, putting themselves at risk. But we definitely want to have those conversations. And, you know, we just want to recognize that everyone is important. We just have to sort of roll this out in a very kind of coordinated way. So grateful for people's taking the time to protect them, continue to protect themselves until vaccine is widely available.
Yeah, thanks for bringing that up. I do. I've learned to hate the term essential worker, because we are all essential in making this happen in so many different ways. And I do think that people are seeing judgment associated with the allocation, and that somehow they're not important or not seen. And that's not the case at all. There are kind of three tenets that we're looking at. We're looking at the science behind it. How do we make sure that we have the least impact of the virus on the morbidity, mortality, the death and sickness associated with COVID-19? And part of the data and science between how do you keep society functioning? Like, how do you make sure essential things happen? It's part of the reason hospital healthcare workers were kind of first, because if they get really overwhelmed, then like strokes and heart attacks don't get treated, and then you get more people dying as a part of that. So how these other things roll down. The second is logistically feasible, trying to just make sure, you know, we can have a very efficacious vaccine, but it's not very effective if we don't get it out in a timely manner to get it to people who need it. And then the third is just equity, really trying to make sure that we're having equal outcomes for people. And sometimes we need to have different access to resources. You know, my daughter, who's otherwise healthy, you know, I'd love it for when she gets it, but the data's not there behind her, and she'd probably do fine. So she's low down on the totem pole, and that's okay. Like, that's fine for her to go later. And it doesn't mean she's any less important to me. It's just from an allocation standpoint, that doesn't make the most sense for our society to do her first versus someone who it has to interface, like the pilots that you guys are prioritizing, others like that are just really critical to being able to transport or being able to take care of all these other conditions.
Great. For anybody who's joining the live stream late or the call late, we just want to remind you that all of the information related to YKHC's COVID-19 response can be found on our website, ykhc.org/COVID-19. And today, as I mentioned at the beginning of the meeting, YKHC announced that we will begin phase 1B vaccinations for elders and frontline essential workers on our COVID-19 website, as well as shared on our YKHC Facebook page. We've provided this information, including the definition for what frontline essential workers will be considered in this initial phase 1B category, and a form for people to fill out if they are interested in being vaccinated. In the last few moments that we have together this evening, I'd like to pose a question to our panelists to give us maybe a sentence or two about why it's important to be vaccinated against COVID-19, whether you would receive the vaccine, whether you would recommend your family to receive the vaccine and why that's so important. And then we'll ask our president and CEO to close us out.
Well, that's a hard question. I guess if I were to say one thing, I would say for hope, because I think this is hope. And just like we have a series of mitigation steps, I think of the vaccine as kind of like your parka. It's your biggest one. And it's the biggest thing that we have right now. It's our biggest tool in mitigating the spread and illness of COVID-19 moving forward. So I highly encourage everyone to get it when it's their turn to get it. I think having patience and grace for people who aren't ready to get it because they want to see more science and data, as well as maybe it's not up their turn yet. But I think having ability to work together is going to be critical in the next few months. And I just really appreciate the partnership with the people of the YK Delta. You have been leaders in this response since the beginning, and speak with you and hear your fantastic questions. So thank you.
Yeah, I would agree with what Dr. Zink says. I think it's about hope. And to me, it's about relief and a little bit about now we have something to do to offer to people to help protect them, other than medications that maybe don't work as well and are really only for people who are really sick. So it gives another tool in our toolbox to help protect people. And for me, it's a sense of immense relief when we are able to vaccinate people, especially now that we can start vaccinating our vulnerable elders, an immense sense of relief. And I received the vaccine and I will recommend it for my whole family once it's their turn.
Yeah, and I think I also received the vaccine and would love all my family members to get it, but they all, unfortunately it's not accessible right now. But I think for me, it's, you know, if I never have to make a phone call to tell the mother that her daughter has to be transported to Anchorage for high level of care and needs a breathing tube, or I never have to speak to a father and tell them that their son is going to pass away alone in a hospital room, or a daughter about her mother, like these conversations are terrible. And anything that I can do, or that I think we can do as a community to prevent those conversations, prevent losing our elders, our loved ones, our brothers and sisters, we will work until the end, day and night. You know, if you see me in a post office or the AC, I wear a pink hat, ask me about vaccines because it's so important, you know, and there's concerns and I understand that people are nervous, but there's a lot of good science. And we're working really hard to learn everything we can. And so we're happy to talk and have those conversations. So please, you know, feel free to touch base with us and ask us. We're open books about vaccines anyway. So, but grateful to have the opportunity to speak with you today.
We're looking at you, Tessa.
I definitely look forward to when I'm able to get the vaccine. I recognize that I'm not at high risk, and so I will gladly wait my turn, but I imagine I'll be one of those people with tears of joy when it is my turn. So I will wait patiently for my turn.
Thanks so much. And Dan, if you could give us any closing thoughts and close us out tonight.
Yes, when it's my turn, I am going to take it, take a picture of it, post it on our website. Also have done some public service announcements in preparation for that. I'm going to encourage everyone who's eligible to also take it as well. I want to protect myself and I want to protect my family. And I also want to protect my neighbors. Post it and do all that cool stuff on Facebook. The other thing too is, you know, it's about science. It's not necessarily about fear or rumors or gossip or bad information from untrusted websites. You can learn all you want. Just go on the CDC website. There's lots of information on there. We have links on our site. We had Dr. Corey here yesterday with other doctors, including our staff, know all about these vaccines and testified to us and all the viewers and the YK Delta that there's no shortcuts that were taken. Rather, there was just certain things that were done at the same time so we could get the vaccine sooner rather than later. Talked about the Pfizer vaccine, the Moderna vaccine, the technology behind it, how it was 17 years in the making. Science, science, science. Science is cool. And in this case, science is going to get us out of this, as well as our own behavior changes. Those two things together are behavior changes, temporarily modifying our leisure activities, and which is really what, visiting other households, visiting, other households. If we can put a hold on that, we'll get through this. And when it's your turn, take the vaccine. And I'm gonna do that, and I can't wait. In the 1980s, in the 1970s, actually in the 1970s and early, very early 80s, hepatitis A and B was ravaging our native people, especially out here in the YK Delta, especially our children. And what saved us there was everyone getting vaccinated. When it was my turn, when I got to be in high school, or actually junior high, got a phone call from, back in those days, it was called ANS, Alaska Native Services. ANS called my mom. My mom said, time to get your shot. I go, what kind of shot? Hepatitis A and B. I go, what's that? She goes, trust me, you'll never have to worry about it if you get your vaccination. She took me down there. I got my vaccination for hepatitis A and B. Could have saved my life. And it saved a lot, countless numbers of Alaska Natives' lives, and especially children in the 80s when that was available. So just as that was available, I am going to be taking this one as well. And then final thoughts is I want to thank our state partners, Dr. Linderman and Dr. Zink. Thank you for participating with us and speaking to the entire YK Delta. Can't say more for our partnership. We look forward to getting more dosages of the vaccine from you. And we look forward to speaking with you on other occasions as well. Thank you very much.
Thank you, everyone. Have a great night.